Welcome to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. This show can be heard on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network every Friday at 1 p.m. and 1 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 a.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Go to dreamvision7radio.com, click Listen Live, and enjoy the show.
Well, hello. This is Dr. Miller, and you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People. 10 years ago, today's guest, Steve Ozanich, was so crippled by back pain that it had resisted every other standard approach that he was scheduled to have very serious spinal surgery. Well, turns out he didn't have the operation, but instead discovered that there was a much more efficient and inexpensive and effective way that he could return to full functioning and eliminate his pain. Then he set about writing a book about what he discovered in the hopes that it could help others. His book, The Great Pain Deception, Faulty Medical Advice is Making Us Worse, was an award-winning finalist in both the Best New Health Book and Health Alternative Medicine categories at last year's International Book Awards held in Los Angeles. Steve's thesis is that a huge percentage of our pain, and nearly all of our back pain, is not actually the result of a structural problem, but is the result of suppressed emotions, such as anger and anxiety, giving rise to what Steve and Dr. Sarno called the tension myoneural syndrome. So let's welcome Steve and see what we can learn about dealing with pain in our lives. Steve, welcome to Conversations. Well, hello. This is Dr. Miller, and you're listening to Conversations with Extraordinary People. 10 years ago, today's guest, Steve Ozanich, was so crippled by back pain that it had resisted every other standard approach that he was scheduled to have very serious spinal surgery. Well, turns out he didn't have the operation, but instead discovered that there was a much more efficient and inexpensive and effective way that he could return to full functioning and eliminate his pain. Then he set about writing a book about what he discovered in the hopes that it could help others. His book, The Great Pain Deception, Faulty Medical Advice is Making Us Worse, was an award-winning finalist in both the Best New Health Book and Health Alternative Medicine categories at last year's International Book Awards held in Los Angeles. Steve's thesis is that a huge percentage of our pain, and nearly all of our back pain, is not actually the result of a structural problem, but is the result of suppressed emotions, such as anger and anxiety, giving rise to what Steve and Dr. Sarno called the tension myoneural syndrome. So let's welcome Steve and see what we can learn about dealing with pain in our lives. Steve, welcome to Conversations.
Hi, Dr. Miller. Thank you for the opportunity to come on and say hello to you and to meet you and to tell you thank you for the work that you did. It was instrumental in my healing, too, along with Dr. Sarno.
Well, thank you.
Okay, yes. I guess it was in the 1970s, maybe, where Dr. Sarno had noticed that, you know, this surgery thing isn't working. You know, it seems like it does if the people believe it, because surgery is definitely the most powerful placebo out there because it's so frightening. But he began looking for other things, and he noticed in his back pain patients that they had all these other things, you know, allergies and dermatological problems, irritable bowel, painful bladder, sleeplessness, anxiety. They had all these other things. So he began to try to talk to these people and try to connect the dots. And he realized these people are perfectionists. They are good people. They're always trying to make people happy around them. They put a lot of personal responsibility on themselves to do good, to do right. And he realized from working with his psychologist there that this is very enraging to people because, you know, we are yin and yang. We are good and bad inside. And a lot of people, we act good on the outside. We really don't want to be at all times. We don't want to have to be good. And so this battle, which he called the divided mind in his fourth book, when this occurs, it's psychological conflict. And when you get conflicted, the tension rises, of course. But I guess he hypothesized that the pain, or this unpleasant symptom, I guess you could call it, comes about as a protective mechanism to protect the people from thoughts that are too powerful, too sad, or too threatening to them. And I guess he came to that conclusion early on because he had a woman that he called Helen in his book, where she developed pain so bad she was bedridden for years, and her family finally got her down to the Rusk Institute to see him. And they found out under deep psychoanalysis that she had been molested as a 5-year-old girl. And when she said when this happened, she started crying when they brought this out. And she said it was like a pipeline from my eyes through my pain, and it just disappeared. And the flags went up right there. He's thinking, all right, maybe this is a protective mechanism. This was too horrifying for her to, you know, to face. So repression, of course. Well, over the 5 decades that he practiced medicine, he came to believe that that was the reason, that it's a protective device. And of course, it goes against the grain of what everyone's telling everyone in modern medicine. You know, let's inject it, let's medicate it, let's cut it, let's send you to physical therapy. But he's saying, you know, the brain wants you to focus on the pain. It wants you to focus on your body. So anytime you do that with a medical doctor, whether you inject it or you go to therapy, you're reinforcing what your brain is already playing the trick on you for. So he's telling them, don't go to the therapy. You're fine, you know. Of course, you got to go get examined. I mean, you have to be a responsible human being. You know, go make sure nothing's serious going on there. But all these normal herniations or these little small partial ligament tears and all these things they're scoping and cutting, he's saying, you know, it's not necessary. And that's exactly what I've seen over the last decade, too. And like I said, I'm not a clinician. And I'm getting emails all the time, your book is helping me to heal. So it is an amazing process, but it's not possible without your work, too. This is very important for me to say. Once I found out early on that I had this, I said, okay, now how do I get out of it? Mm-hmm. My sympathetic nervous system is in gridlock. I knew it. But you can't sense it. If that's the only reference you have in your life, if you've always been stressed and tense, then you don't know any other reference. And when I found your work, I realized, oh, my God, I need to come way down. And then that's when I got, like, easing into sleep and the 10-minute stress manager and deep healing, and I was buying everything you had. But it took a long time. The only life I knew since it started when I was younger was tension. And, of course, it's self-imposed. The self-imposed pressures are the worst ones of all. People can put pressure on you all they want, but if it doesn't bother you, it's okay. If it bothers you, that's the only thing that matters. Well, I healed, and I wanted to write that book to help other people, and it's working. It's working nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting process that what I discovered in, you know, my original work back in the 1970s was that so much of people's pain and dysfunction was really the result of muscle tension and spasm. The interesting thing about how our muscles work, something you every one of us notices, if you're walking across the floor and in the bare feet and you step on a tack, your foot is immediately drawn back from that pain because the muscles contract. So the body's natural response through its muscles to anything that feels like pain is to tense muscles in an attempt to withdraw from whatever that physical pain is. Now, in the world that we live in, because of the unremitting stress, our bodies continue to stay in this fight or flight mode, which has to do with a lot of muscle tension, relaxation, and being frightened that you might be fired, or anxious that some terrorist may blow up a bomb tomorrow, or concerned that your kid's going to get on drugs and drop out of school. I mean, all of those things give tension in the body, whatever it is that's going on. The tension in the muscles, when it's maintained over a long period of time, starts to create low levels of oxygen in the muscles. It cuts off the blood supply, and the muscle becomes inflamed. And when a muscle becomes inflamed, then such chemicals as prostaglandins are secreted into the area of the muscle that's inflamed. This irritates nerve endings, which then feed back to the spinal cord, and it tells the spinal cord and the brain that there's pain, that there's some muscle damage that's going on, kind of like a thumbtack sticking in you. So the body responds, the muscles respond by reflexively tensing. Well, since tension was what caused the problem in the first place, the greater tension leads to more oxygen deprivation, leads to more irritation, more muscle damage, more secretion of those chemicals, more stimulation of the pain fibers, which then feed back to the brain, who says, oh boy, now we're really hurting. We'd better tighten up really hard. And then you end up with what we call muscle spasms. And you can massage the back or shoulder muscles of someone who's been tense for a while. You can feel the knots in the cords that are in that muscle. Well, they can happen in many different areas of the body and many different organs of the body. And when they get into that spasm, you have pain because of the pain spasm cycle. And sometimes it disrupts the functioning of that organ, and then you begin to get signs of and other symptoms of illness. And that's what I found, was that by teaching people how to relax fully, and that is not just relax, 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 but more about drifting into a deep, it takes, in the beginning, it may take 10, 15, 20 minutes for a person to begin to get to that level that we call deep relaxation. But it's at that level that the muscles relax sufficiently that the body can begin to clean up those extra chemicals which have been secreted in that area of the muscle damage, and everything can return back to normal. So that's the link between the deep relaxation and dealing with the myoneural problems that we're talking about.
Right, right. And of course, the first thing you described was, you know, a danger thing, attack you step on. We have to have that pain response, you know, to know whether we're burning ourselves or mm-hmm. whether we're hurting ourselves. So it's a survival response, but then it gets blown out of proportion. You know, the fight and flight, it becomes abused at some point. You know, if you go to your doctor and he says, oh, look, there's your problem right there. And that, then the tension rises. He describes, I think, a 20-year-old guy who had hurt his back brushing his teeth. You know, of course, he was having some stress and tension in his life, but he went to his doctor. And the doctor said, well, you've got a malalignment of your spine. Well, that was it. The guy went into full spasm. Because the doctor, you know, he contributed to the tension by assigning a term to it, a term that frightened people, you know. Well, you've got this disease, fibromyalgia. Now, I was working with a woman last fall. The doctor told her she had fibromyalgia, and it put her in bed. That label of that disease and disorder increased the fight-flight response. And you get locked up in that loop, and you can't get out of it, you know, and relaxation definitely has to be a part of it. But, you know, just relaxation, if you don't take care of some of the psychological conflict, it can keep looping, too. So he always advised people, work on the psychological factors, too. Talk to people, you know, journal. Talk to a counselor. Do something to get rid of it. And, you know, the success rate's amazing, as you know yourself. But it is an amazing process. But, like the subtitle of my books, Faulty Medical Advice is Making Us Worse. In other words, they're attributing it to certain things in the body that are just there. They're just what he called gray hairs of the spine, you know. Mm-hmm. And, but when you say, there's your problem, the person thinks, I've got a disc problem. I can't move. Now I'm going to start limiting my life. I'm not going to bend anymore. I'm not going to do this anymore. And that begins, like you said, that tension process rises and rises and rises. And he's saying, go out and become more aggressive. That's what I did. That's how I healed. You know, I started running again. Where I was on the floor with pillows under my knees for years, mm-hmm. I started to run again, golf again, which I never thought I could do again, and it began to fade. And it's an amazing thing. It really is. But you're right. There's the loop. It begins with something real, and then it gets blown out of proportion, and then the person can't relax.
Yeah. There's a problem when we give names to illnesses, because once you give something a name, then the brain takes that as a reference point.
Yeah, it's tangible now.
Exactly. And in actuality, illnesses, diseases that we have, it's not a thing, it's a process. If you look at that myoneural junction, and there are certain forces, such as tension, that will tend to increase the inflammation. Meanwhile, there are other forces going on from the body which are tending to clean it up and resolve the inflammation, as well as processes like relaxation, which tend to diminish the inflammation. So it's like watching a football game. It's not a static thing. First, one team is pushing. First, the inflammation team is getting worse. And then there's a better response from the body, either because a person's relaxing or eating a better diet or drinking more water or just pushing it back. So it's better to look at what's going on as a process. So the measles, instead of being a thing, we should say the person is measling.
Right.
You know? In other words, there's a process, because the moment you see it as a process, it's the inflammatory versus relaxation process. That's what's going on inside you. And the tension and inflammation have been dominant up until now. But what I want you to do is to shift the focus so that the relaxation and healing becomes more dominant. The inflammation will go away, the tension will go away, and that's how we resolve it. So when we really look at the source, or what we would think of as the cause of the illness, we have to see that it's a process and it should not be named. That's one of the worst things you can do, is to give something a name, because it turns it into a noun.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because I said that in the book several times, that it's a process. There's actually a term that's been coined since his work called TMSing. I'm now TMSing, you know, my knees bother me, I just got fired, my neck's locked up, I've got irritable bladder now. Yeah, these things, they are processes, and we're caught in a cycle of the way the healthcare system's set up to treat symptoms and not causes. They're treating effects. You know, it's like, oh, your knee's bothering you? Well, then let's just cut it open. You know, Instead of saying, well, you know, the first thing that these TMS physicians do that trained under Dr. Sarno is, okay, let's get the history. You know, it's treating the whole person. What Andrew Weil calls it, integrative medicine, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how was your relationship with your parents? Are you divorcing right now? Or is a child sick? You know, who's sick? Someone came up to me in a restaurant recently. My back's killing me. I heard you wrote a book on back pain. And I said, yeah. I said, when's your divorce? And he looked at me, how did you know? It was a 50-50 shot. You know, in America, it's a 50-50 shot. I just got lucky. But he was in the middle of a divorce. He said his blood pressure went up to like 200 over 115 or something, and then it just plummeted the day after the paperwork was signed. You know, it's that direct and that powerful. When we have conflict and when we're angry, because it's anger, you know, anxiety is anger unexpressed. When we have that, the body reacts. And I've always seen it, our health, pain and illness, as a report card of the relationships in our life.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all about connection. It's all about being together and feeling loved and things like that. It may sound cliche to people, but it's true. We want to be loved for who we are, not for what people want us to be. And when these expectations build up to this thing that we can't control anymore, and we don't have a way of expressing it, this is the thing. I realize my back pain, whatever it is, TMJ or whatever, that's you expressing yourself without doing it verbally. You know, I want to say something, but I can't, because I can't, you know, I can't show my true self. I know in Ayurvedic science that I studied, they said, you know, they believed one of the basic tenets was that people get illness and pain because they can't show their true faces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how I've come to see it, too, that is true. That, you know, you want to express then, and you know well, too, that's why journaling and talking to counselors works so well.
Mm-hmm.
Why Freud saw that working so well through Joseph Brouwer was that, you know, they're talking catharsis, they called it. I'm talking. So if you don't have anyone to talk to and you're isolated, not connected, then that's a dangerous place to be, I think, in life, you know, not having good relationship.
And it has to do, you know, all this has to do with what I talk about as being the intensive superficiality of our culture, so that children, as we raise our children, we don't say, please tell me who you are and what your interests are, what makes you feel excited, and I, as your parent, as a steward, will look to see how I can provide you with the experiences that can help you develop who you are and express who you are. Instead, I say, I want you to be this, and I want you to score this in school, and you have to do this, and you have to live up to this, and you have to dress this way, and you have to have this friend, and you're not allowed to have that friend, and on and on and on, as we, in our cultural prejudices and our family prejudices, we do not give our young people, or our adults for that matter, the right to, you know, to express who they are. So, number one, we learn that suppression of who we are to begin with. And then you go to a doctor with a disease that's the result of the fact that you haven't been expressing your truth in life. What the doctor does is he looks at the symptom that you bring. And in most cases in medicine, we do not pay attention to the true source of the illness, because we know that the majority of illnesses have as a major portion, if not the complete portion of the source, as stress. And yet how many doctors pay attention to stress? They may give it a little, well, you have to lower your stress, or yeah, you know, that's about it.
It's that word superficiality that you just used a little bit earlier. That's true. We stopped treating the person. We started treating symptoms. Dr. Sarno called that subtle abuse, what you just mentioned.
Yep.
You know, you got to get all A's. Why can't you be more like that person? Mm-hmm. You know, you got to act this way, you got to do this way. We're not nurturing what the people's talents are. And he said, you know, the parents love the kids. They want them to do better. So he called it subtle abuse. You know, they weren't abusing them on purpose. But the child takes that as, oh, I'm not good enough. And of course, there's low self-esteem in almost everybody that's in chronic pain or illness. You know, they don't feel worthy at some point, and it becomes very philosophical, it really does.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we've gotten to a system where we don't really look at that. And, you know, they say time or whatever. I don't know. I said in my book, it depends on why you went into healing. Did you go into healing to help people or to make a lot of money, you know?
Well, and when you look at the system, when you go into, the practice of medicine or join the medical field, you are entering a system. And the system is a sick care system. In other words, when you get sick, the system takes care of you, and it makes huge amounts of money, not the doctors. I mean, doctors aren't making much money. Doctors are sick. The money's being made by the hospitals, by the pharmaceutical companies, and by the people who manufacture gadgets that can be inserted into your body. That's where the money's going, and it depends on your being sick. If you stop being sick, the system doesn't make money. And in a capitalistic world that we live in, if a system is doing something that's losing its money, like teaching people to be well, then the system stops doing that, because the bottom line is to increase the bottom line. So it's designed to treat symptoms.
I mean, you see pain management signs all over the highways. Why isn't it pain eradication?
That's right.
You know, pain management in itself means, you know, you can't get rid of this, so I'm going to help you kind of, you know, take care of it for the rest of your life. And he said, you know, he used the term in his second book, Healing Back Pain. They've created a nation of the partially disabled. You know, look, you better take it easy now on that knee for the rest of your life. Well,
mm-hmm.
You know, people have come to me after they read my book and said, you know, I was always afraid to do this until I read your story.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how I just went for it, you know. I had nothing to lose. I was so dysfunctional. That was no life. I thought, I've got nothing to lose by listening to this doctor, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which a lot of the other doctors were ridiculing Dr. Sarno. I mean, they kept him from teaching at NYU after a while. They pushed him out, and he was a senior professor. He eventually gave up eating at the cafeteria with the other doctors. He said, you know, that's the last thing. We need good doctors. My book's not an anti-doctor book, not at all. It's an anti-message book.
Right.
You know, and maybe the processes that we're going through. Because I healed, and he healed so many tens of thousands of people. And it's an emerging industry, actually. I think this is the new wave. I don't know what you're seeing, mm-hmm. but it looks like people are beginning to take this mind-body thing seriously.
Yeah,
and they're beginning
to turn. At last. I think it's been 44 years since I wrote my first book on it, and they're finally getting it.
I remember he was in an interview. Some guy, I think from Portugal, was interviewing him. He said, you know, what happened to the medical industry? And Dr. Sarno said, I don't know. They seemed to be better 100 years ago when techno-medicine came in or something. But he said they treat people like auto mechanics. Put them on the racks, raise them up, change the oil, lower them down, see you again next month.
Right. So, but it's like you said, it's like, what is the message when pain comes along or any illness comes along, what our system, we look at it as, okay, this is something negative, and we either have to kill it, cut it out, poison it, or we have to get away from it. We have to retreat from it and avoid it.
Yes.
And in the cases that we're talking about now, you know, so what is the message when that comes? Well, let me ask you this. Would you say that dealing with your back problems has awakened you to something? Do you find it's a gift to you, what you learned?
Yeah, I said that too. It was a gift. And of course, you can't see that when you're in blinding pain. But it pushes you to a higher awareness. And to me, it was a spiritual journey. It doesn't have to be for some people. Some people are atheists that heal with his work too. But for me, it was a spiritual journey. And it pushes you. It's like there's an inner truth just knocking and knocking. You're not listening. You're not listening.
And I don't know.
Louder and louder.
I don't know how many, I mean, gosh, it must be at least hundreds of patients that I have personally heard say to me, cancer was a gift in my life. I mean, people say that. It's just so amazing how often people say it. If they have viewed the cancer or whatever the illness is, okay, this is a sign I need to take a look at myself. Yeah, I need to. Maybe I need to have surgery. You know, maybe I need to have radiation. Yeah, maybe. Maybe that's true. You know, maybe I have to have chemotherapy. But I also want to look at my mind. I want to look at my emotions. I want to look at my spiritual life. I want to look at my relationships. I want to take a holistic look at things because I don't want to leave any stone unturned because I want to live. And in doing that, they open up to a whole new level. And an illness then, a pain, any kind of disappointment that comes along in our lives, if we say, okay, what is this here to teach me? Maybe this is a message to learn something. What can I learn from it? And it's remarkable. When you look at it in that way, the outcome is very, very different. There's a lot less medicine, a lot less surgery, a lot less side effects.
Yeah.
And not only does the physical get better, but all the levels of the being get better.
Yes, and it's probably the deeper level that's really crying to get through. I don't know if you knew Dr. Simonton. Did you know Carl Simonton before he died?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Carl and I were doing, he was using imagery and these kind of processes of self-knowledge, working specifically with cancer patients when I was applying it across the board to everyone I saw in my office. And then I got together with the Creightons. As a matter of fact, there's a new product that I'm just releasing now called Confronting Cancer, Facing, Embracing, and Thriving. And it's with the woman who designed Carl's training program, Maggie Creighton, and I. We started the first training institute to teach people a new way to look at cancer, to actually empower cancer patients to participate in their own healings.
Exactly. So, you know, in that book, his book, Getting Well Again, was one of my favorite books.
Classic book.
And I talked to him before he died. When I found out he had choked to death at home, it shocked me.
Mm.
And I think it was 07 or 08, I can't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a pioneer, and he asked his cancer patients, you know, what is there any benefits? And they actually wrote what you said, you know, it enabled them to move to another level. You know, I think, you know, the cancer cell, when it, that scientists say it expresses itself, you know, when it goes cancerous, and maybe that is the body expressing itself. I remember Dr. Weil, Andrew Weil, he said in his book that, you know, these people, they, if they treat it as a foreign invader, they do worse.
Mm-hmm.
But if they treat it as part of themselves that they need to deal with and need some compassion, that they tend to do a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I hear people say, you know, I'm going to fight this thing, I cringe. You know, I'm going to fight this thing with every ounce of my being. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I talked about that television commercial for the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where that woman, Peggy Kessler, was told she only has a few months to live. And her family took her to the Mind-Body Center, the CTCA in Texas. And she's fine now. She said, they gave me hope. And that is everything. Hope, 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 you know. And you say, well, we can't do anything more. That's it. That person's done. You've killed them by saying, I can't do anything more for you. Just say, you know, there's always some type of hope. There's always hope, you know. And she seems to be fine now. And, yeah, that's kind of cool that you're into that. What was the name of that book or whatever you're working with? Crichton's? Was it the Crichton?
No, the Crichton?
Yeah, it was Stephanie Crichton was the
one. Yeah, Crichton. He, yeah, they co-wrote Getting Well Again.
Yeah.
But this is a video program in which we went over all the things that we taught at the Cancer Center, which are still very far in advance of what people are doing in cancer groups now. It's called Confronting Cancer. So it's a video that's available through my website.
Okay, I'm excited to see that. You know, of course, the conversation went from pain to cancer because I viewed it all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a message that if you're ignoring it, it's going to keep knocking louder and louder, you know. And
yeah, well, you know, we're raised to really see ourselves as being very helpless. And in a world that's very, very scary, the news, magazines, commercials, everything is out there saying you're helpless, you're not good enough, you got to buy our product, you need us to protect you, you need more of an army to protect you, you'd better have a gun, da-da-da-da-da. In other words, there's this whole thing that we're brought up to feel helpless in a world surrounded by negative things. And so at the moment that something goes wrong, like there's a pain in our body that we don't understand, or we get diagnosed as an illness or whatever, we immediately feel helpless, and we submit ourselves to the doctor or the witch doctor or whoever it is. We look for the magic pill, what's the diet that I can change to make this better, or what's the supplement that I can take, or what's the vitamin that I can take. And boy, you can, you know, go on the internet, write down vitamins for, and put down any illness, and you'll see somebody advertising they have a vitamin that cures it. You write down supplement, and there's someone who's got a supplement that cures it. And if you say physical exercise, they've got a physical exercise that cures it, because we feel helpless, and therefore we can be sold something from the outside that can somehow take care of us, instead of what the opposite way is, that we have power, and that when there's a problem going on inside, it is an imbalance. What happened, Louis Pasteur came along with his germ theory of illness, and there was quite an argument at the time, him versus a fellow named Claude Bernard. Claude Bernard said, no, host factors are the most important thing. And Louis Pasteur said, no, the presence of the germ is the most important thing. Well, it's much more mechanical and easy to understand when you see a germ under the microscope inside of a wound and you say, okay, this is the cause. But on Pasteur's deathbed, he said, you know, I think Bernard was right. In other words, the illness happens in us because our defenses have broken down. Most often, they break down because we are not dealing with stress appropriately. We're letting ourselves stay under high levels of stress. The cortisol is destroying the tissues of our body, and then an illness, a disease, can get started in it. We're not exercising. We're not in the right kinds of relationship. We're not experiencing the love that we are designed to have. It's a nutrient. Without that nutrient, we don't live, just as if you deny the body an essential nutrient. And it shows up in the body as an imbalance, which we see as either a sign of a disease that comes up on a blood test or a symptom. But when we go in to get help, all people do is help us with their symptoms, unless we do something like read a book like The Great Pain Deception, Faulty Medical Advice is Making Us Worse, which is written by our guest today here on Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People. And let me say one other thing, you know, back when I was around 29 years old, I was an avid skier. I loved to ski really hard mountains. I like to ski down the slopes you could spit down, you know.
Jackson Hole.
And watch it, yeah. And then I was showing off one day, and I carried this huge, heavy backpack off into, you know, to a hiking expedition for about 6 hours in sub-zero weather and injured my back. So I went to the doctors, and they say, oh, you have to do Williams flexion exercises, which I did. And that kind of kept the back from being excruciating most of the time, but forget it. I couldn't do any activity, no sports, no basketball, and no skiing. And I was depressed for about 4 years because basketball and skiing, that's a lot of my life was that's where I really felt the best. And then I was giving a talk one day, and the physical therapist came up to me afterward, and she said, you know, what you're teaching parallels what I teach in doing physical therapy about, in other words, we don't say to a person, okay, move your arm. How's that? Does that hurt? Try this. Does this hurt? Try this. Does this hurt? But instead, we say, hi, does this try this. Does this feel okay? And does this feel okay? And does this feel okay? And it makes a major difference, the words you use. And then I told her about my back. And she said, oh, well, try some extension exercises. You shouldn't be doing Williams exercises. And it was really hard for me to get into a cobra position. But after about 2 or 3 weeks of practice, I was able to do that. And presto, I was playing basketball and skiing again and having a great time. So, I mean, it's amazing how the medical system often does not know how to give you the tools that you need and doesn't know how to look for where's the tension and what needs to be relaxed.
And what you mentioned a couple minutes ago about the germs, those TMS physicians have said that to me too, that it's often incidental to the problem. You get rid of the infection and the problem's still there.
Right.
But they blame it on the germ. I referenced Claude Bernard in my book, something about, he said, illnesses hover over us constantly. They never set in the terrain until the soil is ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know if you studied Henry Beiler or not, too. He studied germs his whole life. He said, it's not coming from germs. They're just there. You know, there's something else that's allowing them to thrive. And so we're looking at the wrong things. And that's why, you know, faulty medical advice is making us worse. And I wanted to grab that headline to have people ask, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, and it's not that doctors aren't bad people. Dr. Sarno's even said, you know, take it easy on the doctors. Take it easy on them. You know, they think they're doing good. But the system is set up to treat, you know, symptoms.
Yeah, and the system does not train doctors in how to treat the whole person. They trains doctors to be specialists. And each doctor is really good. A dedicated doctor is fantastic in terms of being able to deal with the illnesses and diseases and sicknesses of that part of the body that they focused on. But because they're focused on the detail, they cannot see the big picture. It's like the wise man and the elephant, except that we're the elephant with these diseases breaking all over our bodies and seeing 16 different specialists instead of standing back and say, hey, wait, all of this is really one big animal.
Yeah, and part of that touches on something we haven't talked about, which is the placebo, because sometimes these people will get great results based on their reputation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, that guy must be good. He's farther away. I have to go 2 hours to see him, and they come back, you know, he's good, I feel better. It's their belief.
That's right.
Their belief in the surgery or the drug and all these things, you know. And so when Dr. Sarno would tell them, you're fine, they often would heal right there.
Mm-hmm.
Because he suddenly, well, first of all, there's relaxation, you know. The deeper brain, all of a sudden, it's not on high alert. I'm fine.
Ah.
And all of a sudden, they would go down. But, of course, it will return if the psychological conflict remains. But it's the placebo is such an interesting thing. I spent several chapters on that. I mean, just the power of words. We touched on that a little bit ago.
Mm-hmm.
The words that these doctors use. I was working with a woman. She developed hand pain so bad, she was under a lot of stress and tension. She could no longer use her hands. They hurt so bad. And so she started dialing the phone with her feet and changing the TV remote with her feet. And her mother came by and said, "Boy, I hope that doesn't go into your feet." In a few hours, she couldn't walk anymore. It had moved into her feet.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are very, very suggestible. And I think that's why I put that Claude Bernard quote in there. He said,
mm-hmm.
"It doesn't set into the terrain until the soil is ready."
Mm-hmm.
When people have prolonged periods of stress and tension and low self-esteem, any word that comes along can drop that person and disable them. And any word of hope can do the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it comes to me down to a spiritual thing. Do you want to stay with that light? You know, don't let things overpower you. Don't let things that are part of darkness overpower you. And it's an internal battle. It's part of the battle of life, you know,
mm-hmm.
that we have.
Well, placebo is a Latin word. It means I will please. And that's because we have this enormous unconscious brain. We know what is the limbic system and the cingulate gyrus of the brain, the amygdala, the hippocampus, and so forth, which is, as many people know, that's an area that's always on guard, and it's always looking at the world trying to see if there's anything dangerous going on. But this part of the brain, this deeper part of the brain, wants to please you. And so whatever you believe to be true, this part of your brain will act to make it true, because it desires to please you. And so when you go to see the great man or the great healer and the great healer, you know, it can be Britney Spears, if you believe in Britney Spears, and she touches you. And ever since Britney Spears touched my shoulder, my neck hasn't hurt ever again, because I believe that Britney Spears has that power. And the unconscious part of my mind says, okay, I will cause your neck to act in a way consistent with what you believe. Just in the same way as if you imagine sucking on a lemon, that deeper part of your mind will cause your mouth to salivate, because it is trying to please by acting in such a way as to ratify what your belief is. And so there's a superficial level of placebo in which if you believe the sugar pill is going to help you, you take it and then it helps you for a while. But as you said, Steve, if the psychological problem is still there, if the stress is still there, it'll come back. And so hypnosis, placebos of all kinds have been thought to be, oh, it only works for a short period of time. Well, there's a deeper kind of placebo. And a deeper placebo is when a person says, I have the power to heal myself. I have the power to transform my life. I have the power to discover what's missing in my life and to do what I need to do in order to fill my life with the love and the interest and the rest and the good food and the exercise, the meditation and the mental imagery that I need. I have the power to do that, and I choose to do that. And then your deeper mind says, okay, in that case, I will please you by letting your body and mind and emotions become healthy. And they stay healthy because you're developing patterns in your life that support it. So expanded notion of placebos, not just a temporary thing, but when you really understand what's going on, when you say, in what way is this illness an opportunity for me to grow? How can I take what appears to be an obstacle, look at it as a challenge, and turn it into an opportunity?
That's a good point, that there's different levels of placebos. I did quote, was it Michael J. Fox in my book? Because I have, I think chapter 25 is on, you know, the passes, the suffering. What it lights the fires of consciousness. It burns up the ego because you have more compassion for people. His book, when he got Parkinson's disease, he called his book Lucky Man. I'm a lucky man.
Mm-hmm.
He said, it's going to give me... I remember David Letterman going, really? You really think you're a lucky man? He goes, absolutely. And you could tell he meant it. He said, it's going to give me an opportunity now to understand something I didn't. Well, there's not a lot of people with that much of maturity
mm-hmm.
to do that. But it is true. At some point, you know, something deeper in me wants something to be known.
Yeah.
And this is an opportunity. But, you know, I don't even know if I have the strength to say that if something bad happens. But mm-hmm. something happens to me, I'm going right to a psychologist.
Right.
Because I want to know what I know now is something's going on here.
And was it the Michael J. Fox reference that to compassion, did you say?
I did in my book, and I mentioned him uh-huh. talking about how he's the lucky guy. He's got something to learn now. Because Parkinson's is an odd one. I studied that, and it is one of the more ones that's susceptible to a placebo. They're mm-hmm. saying in the study's designer. I mentioned this one woman. She was in a wheelchair, and they did some type of thing, embryonic stem cells on the brain or something.
Mm-hmm.
And a year later or so, she was ice skating and jogging and doing all kinds of things. When they brought her back in from the double blind, they said, we didn't do anything to you.
Mm-hmm.
We just made an incision on your scalp, and we closed it back up. She was part of the control group.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, certain things, and I don't know, it could be that... It is that placebo. I remember Dr. Weil saying, you know, the placebo gets a bad rap.
Right.
How do you know it's not just a placebo? How do you know that's not a placebo? Well, he said the doctor is actually looking for something that the patient will believe in that will ratify their own healing powers.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's kind of this mediator. You know, let's try this. We'll try this. You know, he's searching. He's a facilitator. And if you can find that thing that your deeper self believes, like you just said, you will heal. You will heal, but you know, some people it may be just be a sugar pill.
Mm-hmm.
Other people, like me, it had to be a deeper spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm. And what else did you discover as you looked deeper into yourself?
that's a great question, mm-hmm. by the way. No one's asked me that yet mm-hmm. all year. That we are all one the same. Everybody's got this. Everybody has fear. We're all from the same spirit. We're only separated by experience. I can see people with TMS all around me.
Mm-hmm.
I can see the emotional problems. And
it opened your ability to experience compassion.
Yes, and of course, I'm paying it forward. I want to go back and help those same people.
Yeah.
They're helping me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And part of the compassion and being compassionate for others, we also need to be compassionate for ourselves.
Yeah, at first. I think that's true. I found out I have to love myself before I can ever know how to love somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but these people, they beat themselves up and they beat themselves up until they got pain and disease. But and you talk about that a lot. You know, the learned helplessness,
mm-hmm.
and loving yourself, and that it all sounds cliche, but it's so true.
Mm-hmm.
I can't love another person if I don't love myself, because we project everything inside of us out to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So. You asked a great question there. No one's asked. I learned compassion, and I always helped people. That doesn't mean you're compassionate, you know. And you can understand why somebody did something to you. It doesn't mean you forgive them, you know. True forgiveness and true compassion are something totally different.
Mm-hmm.
than I guess you used the word earlier, superficiality. I'm going to use that word from now on.
Right. Yeah. That to me, that's my definition of spirituality is separating the superficial from the essential. And then choosing to pursue that essential and let that guide your life rather than this superficial fashions of the day or momentary stressors.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a great definition, too. And people say, well, you know, how do I heal, Steve? Well, it's not that simple when the human brain is involved and when
mm-hmm.
relationships are involved and the depth of fear and all these things. It's not that simple. Or you could say, listen, go do this and this and you'll be fine. You know, there would be no doctors, there would be no psychiatrists in the world, right, if you could just say X equals this. But it's not that simple.
It's not that simple, but it is that important. And I think your compassion certainly shows in the book that you've written, and I really want to thank you for that and for all the people that you've helped. We've been speaking with Steve Ozanich
author of The Great Pain Deception, Faulty Medical Advice is Making Us Worse. His book is available at my website, drmiller.com. If you write Ozanich or Pain Deception in the search bar, you'll find it pretty quickly. It's been great talking with you today, Steve.
Thank you, and I just want to formally say I could not have healed without your work, too. It was very important to me, and I always try to recommend it, and I've gotten great feedback from it. So, you know, this is a team effort between people who really want to help people.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Dr. Miller.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, the interesting thing is that stories like Steve's are amazingly not uncommon, at least in my experience. The Japanese gymnast Fujimoto was ranked as one of the best, and in an important competition, he did his first two exercises beautifully, but at the end of the second, he broke his leg. The next day, he showed up to do the stationary rings exercise. The routine required him to land on both legs and hold this position for a required length of time. He did so, scored himself a perfect 10, and immediately collapsed. The next day in the hospital, a reporter said to him, "That must have been very painful, landing on a broken leg." Fujimoto said, "Yes, it was painful, but today the pain is gone, and I have the gold." Pain is something that has a very special emotional impact in most of our lives. We learn about pain as an infant, as a child, where a tiny prick with a diaper pin can send an infant screaming as if his life was being destroyed. So pain tends to have an emotional aspect to us. There's certainly a physical aspect, because sometimes the damage does come from the outside, but not always. Then there's an emotional aspect of it, and then there's a belief aspect of it. For instance, if a businessman is crossing the street and gets hit by a car, and at the same moment a soldier gets a wound on the battlefield, the next day both of them will be being cared for. The soldier won't be having much pain because he's got a broken leg, so he's not going to be going out there to be shot at tomorrow. Whereas the businessman, he's really upset because he missed an important meeting and now he's stuck in bed and won't be able to make it to his ski date this weekend. The levels of pain that they will be experiencing will be very, very much different because of the circumstances in which they see themselves. So our self-image and our beliefs about the world have a tremendous amount to do with how much pain and discomfort that we feel. So I found in my work that, first of all, by learning to go into a deeply relaxed state, by relaxing the body fully, we let go of unnecessary emotions and pain immediately starts to become less. As pain becomes less, then we stop tensing that muscle up. The natural response of the body to pain is to tense the muscle, but often that will actually make the pain worse, especially if the pain started out as having a large emotional component to it. When you say someone's a pain in the neck, it represents the fact that you actually tend to get tension in your neck muscles when you're really annoyed by someone. So the relaxation can immediately begin to relieve some of the discomfort. But then beyond that, there are the thoughts and the images that we have in our mind. And so by guiding our mind, in other words, by using guided imagery, we can guide ourselves to think about our bodies in such a way that the discomfort becomes much, much less. There are two basic ways to go about this. One of them is what we might call a dissociation style of an intervention. In other words, that our fear that pain is going to get worse and worse and become intolerable increases our internal tension, releases chemicals within the body that intensify the pain. But when we intentionally use dissociation, we can interrupt that connection. And so you begin to imagine that part of your body that has been hurting is far away. You imagine getting some anesthetic into it, or imagine it's freezing over and cooling and pain going away. That's the technique that I generally use, and it's what you can hear on the Change the Channel on Pain CD, which I'm going to play you a little bit of it in a few moments. The other approach could be called an immersion approach, or perhaps a mindfulness approach. And I use both of these when I'm working with people. It's interesting how they can work with each other. Let me just focus on the first of those techniques in our experiential work today. And so if you're in a place where you can do so, allow yourself to sit back and relax. I'm going to play a little bit of Change the Channel on Pain. So if you're in a place where you can do so, sit back, let your eyelids close. Take a deep breath in. As you let it out, empty your mind, let your body relax. And imagine that you're lying on a beach. A very pleasant day. And as you're lying on that beach, focus your awareness on your hands. And imagine that you're going to allow one of those hands now to become numb. After we've numbed the hand, we move that hand to whatever part of your body you want to become pain-free. So just focus on your hands now.
And as you're lying there, you're noticing that one of your hands is beginning to feel a little different from the other. One hand feels as if it's going to sleep. You're still awake, and yet one of your hands is beginning to have a feeling as though you're wearing a glove up to your wrist or up to your elbow. Let yourself notice which hand is beginning to have this fuzzy, indistinct feeling. You may notice that it's becoming difficult to tell where one finger stops and the next one begins. It's almost as though your hand and wrist and the lower part of your arm are beginning to blend into the air around them. A very pleasant, far away, insensitive feeling is developing in that hand. It may even be difficult to locate that hand in space. It may feel as if it's floating, or that the arm is extended out to the side somewhat. And as you continue to relax comfortably, you may think to yourself, what would help this hand feel even more numb and insensitive? Perhaps you can imagine this hand is immersed in a bucket of ice water and feel it so realistically that you can begin to feel the coldness and even feel the cubes and chips of ice floating around in that water, gradually letting that coldness and numbness enter the hand. And your hand will remain very, very comfortable and grow more and more numb as all feeling is leaving this hand. In a moment, I'm going to ask you to touch this hand 3 times with your other hand. And each time you touch it, it will grow more numb.
You've been listening to a segment of Change the Channel on Pain. This is Emmett Miller, and I'd like once again to thank today's guest, Steve Ozanich. If you have any questions, comments, or contributions you'd like to share with us, please do so. It's been great to have you here with us. Please join our ongoing conversation at facebook.com/AskDrMiller. That's Ask Dr. Miller. And so, until we meet again, remember, stay tuned.
You've been listening to Dr. Emmett Miller's Healing Times Radio, Conversations with Extraordinary People on Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. For more information about Dr. Miller's work, his upcoming events, new programs, and how you can change your mind and change your life, visit his multimedia website at drmiller.com. That's drmiller.com. If you would like to take advantage of Dr. Miller's 20% discount on all of his MP3 guided imagery programs, visit shopdrmiller.com, locate your desired program, and use the promo code DREAM, all lowercase, when checking out. Conversations with Extraordinary People is produced in the drmiller.com studios. Special thanks to Jesse Churchill and Deborah Beauvais.